From today's Committee on Regional Affairs hearing, with me today is Senator Ellis, Senator Kukesh, Senator Menard, myself, Senator Olson. Since this is being teleconference and recorded, we ask that everybody turn off their cell phones and Blackberries. Today we're going to hear first Senate Bill 96, which is the application for Village Safe Water. We'll hear a presentation regarding the tsunami modeling and emergency preparedness. At this time, Senate Bill 96, the committee has already heard this bill previously, and the plan is to go ahead and pass it out. There will be public testimony if somebody decides to go ahead and testify. With that, I'd like to, there's a CS that is there, and I have my aide, Dave Scott, to go ahead and explain the committee substitute. But before we do that, we'll go ahead and adopt the CS.
Thank you, Senator Menard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to move forward the CS for Senate Bill number 96-D.
Any objection to adopting Senate Bill 96-D committee substitute? If not, go ahead and with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. The one difference between with the new CS, backslash D from backslash I, is on line 7, we change city to municipality. What this does is there's one municipality that would be brought in and be eligible for Village Safe Water funds, and that is Yakutat.
Senator Kukesh, since you're the primary sponsor for the bill, do you have any problem with that?
No, absolutely not. We work with your staff, and we work with Ledge Legal, and we're fine with it.
Okay.
I had a chance to talk to Kathy Wassman just really quick, and everything seems good.
With that, do we have anybody with public testimony who wants to testify on this bill? If not, do we have any amendments, other amendments to the bill? Any discussions for the bill? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menard.
I move the CS for Senate Bill 96-D to out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Any objection? If not, this bill moves from committee. With that, we'll go ahead and have the tsunami preparedness presentation to us now come back in. We're going to get ease at this point. Called the CNR meeting back into session. Next, we'll have a presentation for the tsunami preparedness by the presenters that are here, and there's one online. We have Dr. Roger Hansen. He'll be first to come on up here and present. Dr. Hansen is from the Geophysical Institute there at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. With that, Dr. Hansen, go ahead with your presentation.
All right, thank you. First, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to this. I'm the state seismologist from Alaska, a professor at the university with the Geophysical Institute, and the director of the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, where we do a lot of the modeling of the tsunamis.
Let's have it at easier. Okay, we'll go back on the record. Dr. Hanson, we apologize and want to go ahead and, for the interruption, we want to welcome Senator Wagner to our committee. Please go ahead with your presentation. If you'd like to start at the beginning, so Senator Wagner will have the benefit of your opening comments.
Again, I said thank you for inviting me to this. I'm a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the state seismologist for Alaska. I'm director of the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, where we monitor for earthquakes and do a lot of studies and modeling of tsunamis. And so I was asked to come here to talk about earthquakes, tsunamis, and our seismic networks. And so I have a presentation here that I hope is not too long, but it goes through a number of the important points about safety from earthquakes and tsunamis. Some of the take-home points we have is that Alaska is the biggest earthquake and tsunami producer in the United States. And secondly, what our danger is from earthquakes and tsunamis is not distant like we just saw in Japan. It's local. We're going to have local earthquakes that create local tsunamis, and we're going to have communities hit and ready to be and prepared to be able to handle these disasters from tsunamis within 30 minutes. As I said, the Japanese event put out tsunamis ocean-wide across the Pacific. There was one fatality in California from somebody who went down to take pictures when he shouldn't have been down there. But no fatalities and pretty much no damage here in Alaska because we're just not so vulnerable to distant events, but we're extremely vulnerable to close-in events. So it's very important that people know what to do, and it's a matter of life and death. That requires a very concerted effort of education and outreach, preparedness and mitigation. And this is only done through partnerships, and the partnerships include many of the university and state and federal agencies that are here today. Some other take-home points and action items that I'll get to. It has to do with the modernization of the Alaska Seismic Network. This is critical and still the primary way of rapidly identifying and understanding both damaging earthquakes and tsunamis. Most of the older instrumentation in our network, and you'll see this later, has been modernized already, but there's still large areas of our state that have very sparse coverage and very poor understanding of when earthquakes occur. Fortunately, there's a solution ahead. There's a National Science Foundation project that is going to be moving to Alaska in the next 2 to 3 years. It's something called EarthScope. NSF, instead of funding a large telescope to look in space, they're instead focusing into the Earth, and they're going to be using seismometers to do this. So they're going to put about 300 seismic stations throughout Alaska. They're to be left in place for 2 years and then taken out, but we have the ability to take over ownership at a much reduced cost. So that's something we're very, very interested in doing. Lastly, I think the other action item for us is to make sure that we reauthorize the federal law that funds our tsunami activities. This law is known as the Tsunami Warning and Education Act. It's scheduled to sunset in 2012. And it's very, very important that we work with our federal partners to get that reauthorized and, in fact, some of the language potentially improves so that states get the necessary amount of funding to do the work that we need to do. So the outline of my talk is to talk a little bit about the big picture of earthquakes in Alaska, monitoring with our seismic network, as I mentioned, getting out information to the people that need to know about earthquakes quickly, and then I'll transition to how earthquakes cause tsunamis, predicting the flooding from tsunamis in our coastal towns, mostly through modeling efforts that we do up at the university. And then, in addition, many of our communities are quite prone to tsunamis from landslides, so I wanted to present some of that, too. To start with, earthquakes are a release of energy in our Earth. The energy, and if you ask fourth graders in schools in Alaska, they know this. They know, you ask them, where does the energy come from earthquakes? And what they say is, it's coming from the heat from the center of the Earth. And what happens is that heat causes the mantle of the Earth to boil, and that's why there's a Bunsen burner with water. It's boiling. It creates these cells. As this boils, I don't have a pointer, so I can't do much with this, but as it boils, material comes up, becomes part of the lithosphere, and causes the tectonic plates to move. when they move and collide with each other, they subduct. Where they subduct is called a trench. Alaska is built right on top of one of these trenches. And so as these tectonic plates move together, one is shoved under the other, and that's what creates these earthquakes. If you open up the world to be flat and look at these spreading centers, you see them through the middle of the oceans. The places where we have these collisions or the subduction zones or trenches are shown here. And we've just had big earthquakes in Chile, in Japan, as well as in Alaska from these kinds of activities. The plates are moving, the Pacific plate moving northward toward Alaska. That's what gives rise to our earthquakes, not only on that boundary, but the forcing of those plates causes strain energy throughout the entire state, giving us earthquakes to Nome, to Barrow, the North Slope, everywhere. This is illustrating that, in fact, this is an extension of the San Andreas Fault, because it's the same system that causes the earthquakes that are so famous in California. But those are little earthquakes compared to what we see in Alaska. This map shows where many of the fault lines are and many of the outlines of what we see are as big earthquakes. This is that trench again, showing the plate from the Pacific hitting North America. And what happens is that plate is forcing underneath. That is what's causing earthquakes. It sticks due to friction. It builds up, and then it releases in very big earthquakes. Gave rise to the 9.2 in 1964. Second largest earthquake ever recorded. In 1965, there was an 8.7 out at the other end of the trench. In 57, there was an 8.6. This one was a much longer rupture zone, but it didn't rupture as much, and so it was a lower magnitude. So you can get various variations in the amount of rupture and the amount of magnitude you get. 1946, we had a much smaller event here, but it was important because it created a tsunami that completely wiped out the Scotch Cap Lighthouse, sent a wave down to Hawaii that killed several people, hundreds of people. And that is what was the beginnings of the first Tsunami Warning Center. So Alaska's been involved in tsunamis for many, many years now, and involved in the trying to prepare safe capabilities for the residents. Also, there's the, again, as I said, like a San Andreas Fault, we get smaller events over here. In particular, we've had an 8.1 down in 1949, a 7.6 in 1972, the famous 7.9 in 58, which created the Lituya Bay slide and the huge wave from it, 6.8 in 2004. In addition, as I said, this imparts energy into the interior of the state, and that's because there is, as the plates push together, it starts rotating energy, rotating the crust about. And this is what's called the Denali Fault. And of course, what we know is that while we thought that that fault was not that terribly active, in 2002 it produced a 7.9 earthquake. It was quite destructive. Luckily, nobody died from that one. But it ruptured about 350 kilometers of that fault. And you notice that the extent of that fault runs right next to Juneau down here through the Lynn Canal. So just out our window is a fault that is potentially dangerous. Farther over is the Queen Charlotte Fairweather Fault that's much like the San Andreas. This is another area where we don't have enough seismic stations, and I'll show that in a minute. Damage from the Denali Fault was quite spectacular. A couple of things I wanted to point out is that the pipeline suffered some minimal damage. It was really quite fortunate. It pushed it to the limits of its design, but managed to make it through. Alyeska at that point partners with us now. And so we run the seismic network that monitors that pipeline, and we send them alarms, we send them notifications of earthquake occurrence, magnitudes, strong ground shaking. So that's been a real positive win-win situation between a university and a private corporation. One of the last things I wanted to show from the Denali Fault is this landslide that came. Now, if you'd imagine that this was at Lituya Bay, these rocks down at the bottom here are the size of houses. mean, so this is a huge amount of volume that all of a sudden went in the water, or would have gone in the water. Here we, it landed on a glacier. These are the kinds of things that happened to create tsunamis from some of these large earthquakes. So the seismic threat in Alaska, what we see here is we have some of the world's largest earthquakes. Three of the larger of the 10 largest ones ever recorded were here in Alaska. We now have to add the Chile 8.8 and the Japan 9.0. That'll move the 7 and 8 down, but we're still three of the top 10. Not that we're proud of this, but it's something that we need to know and understand and be aware of to be safe. What I wanted to point out here is this also has a slide with a bar graph of the number of events in California versus Alaska. And just so that you understand, we have about 75% of North America's earthquakes, and we catalog about 25,000 earthquakes a year. That's something like a magnitude 8 every 13 years, magnitude 7 every other year, probably 10 magnitude 6s a year, etc. If we show a map of all the events that we've cataloged for the last 5 years, say, ending in August of 2009, actually, we see this pattern. And, of course, we see that trench area of the subduction zone dominating the picture. They're color-coded with depth, so what you're seeing is the blue is shallow, followed by green, then orange, then red, and that is that dipping slab that's illuminated by earthquakes. But apart from that, we're seeing a lot of the blue or shallow events extending all the way up north to Prudhoe Bay. In the North Slope, we've seen several magnitude 5-plus earthquakes there. Over near Fort Yukon, magnitude 5-plus. Over in the Bering Strait, we see potentially magnitude 7 to 7.5 events there. And up near Red Dog, magnitude 6s were happening there over the past few years. So there's earthquakes that happen everywhere in the state. This is a point that we need to drive home, is that we can have earthquakes anywhere in our state. Now, how do we monitor these? We monitor these, like I said, with something like an earth scope or seismic instruments that measure the ground shaking. The very first one of these, I call this the century of seismic monitoring, because our first one went in 1904 in Sitka. The second one went in 1935 up at UAF. And the third one went in following the 1964 earthquake. So it's been a very slow process. But following the 64 earthquake and a better understanding of plate tectonics, it became a push, a drive to understand these kinds of earthquakes. So different institutes put these in, including the Geophysical Institute, the USGS, and NOAA, the Tsunami Warning Center, because that was the beginning of the Tsunami Warning Center here in Alaska. We've been modernizing this integrated network with new instrumentation. We now do real-time processing and archiving with a modern management system. Better site preparation, but we still have a very sparse network relative to the size of our state. If you were to plant Southern California in here, they would have more stations than we have for the entire state so that they can understand the earthquake risk that they have. But if you look out here where we expect these magnitude 7.5s out near Nome, we're lucky to have four stations in that region. You can take the entirety of Oregon and Washington and put them into northern Alaska, and they would have no seismic stations. So what we want to be able to do is improve that. Part of what we've been doing at the Alaska Earthquake Information Center is improving the quality of these stations and adding numbers as we can. So part of our job is to monitor by installing remote seismic stations. We do this through placing these where we do have earthquakes, and digging holes, building piers, and placing the instruments, powering them remotely with either wind or solar, and transmitting that data through phone or radios or whatever VSAT systems we can get our hands on. In addition, we then bring the data in real time to the information center. We analyze it, archive it, and then we can report on earthquakes to agencies that need this. This is a wordy slide, but basically it's just saying that an integration of all the seismic data for Alaska is happening in one spot within this information center, whether it's coming from UAF, from the Tsunami Warning Center, from USGS, from the Volcano Observatory. So all of it can be processed together to get results. Then we put out products, and one of the things to point out here is that we get automatic earthquake locations by sensing immediately the energy that comes on a seismic station and having a location and magnitude in 1 to 2 minutes. That's for local events here in Alaska. Now, regional or not regional, but more distant events such as Japan, it's a little more problematic because you have to have the travel time of the P waves. We were able to locate and assign a magnitude of 9.1 to the Japan earthquake within 13 minutes of its occurrence. That was quite a success story for us because I think that was the fastest and most accurate initial response that was found anywhere. We also put out information releases. These go out as either faxes, they go over cell phones, we even have notification computers that we put in many of the emergency offices around the state. And the last thing I wanted to point out as a product is the Shake Map. This is a USGS product that we run within our system that uses stations, the kind of seismic stations that stay on scale and allows us to very quickly color contour map with the strength of shaking. So that helps emergency managers to know where to go to help people. Here is that shake map that you would get for the Denali Fault earthquake. It's nice to see that we had a lot of strong shaking, but it didn't concentrate around the pipeline. So we were lucky. And if that red part that's down more to the east would have been at the pipeline, we would have had 8 more feet of offset. And some of these sliders would have fallen off, and we could have had a much bigger disaster. We didn't have that. It's fantastic. To improve our seismic network, there's this thing called EarthScope I mentioned. This is funded by NSF, has many partners, does a number of things, including GPS stations. And if you look at the lower 48 down here, you see all these white triangles. So those are permanent stations that they're putting in as part of this. But what's even more interesting are the little black dots. Those are these temporary stations that are going to be rolling across the country. There's 400 of them that get installed at any one time. And they're 400 with a 70-kilometer spacing on a 1,500 by 1,500-kilometer grid. So that gives us very uniform coverage. And these are the first 400 of these that were installed, starting in California and moving east. At this point, they're past the Mississippi River. When they get to the East Coast and every site's been occupied for 2 years, it's all going to come up to Alaska. And the projection shows this. Can you see that? Yeah, you can see the circles where they're projecting seismic stations. This is going to be fantastic. If we have this for 2 years only, it's a fantastic thing. But to be able to keep this will be an absolute boon for seismology here in Alaska. It populates the southeast. It very well populates the north and the western parts of Alaska. So that's one of my action items and take-homes, is to make sure that we look for a way to fund keeping these things. We also do education and outreach. We put out pamphlets. These pamphlets happen to be in the bag already that they gave you. We support research in seismology. This shows some of those deep earthquakes going down under Mount McKinley. So you see a lot of shallow events up where those red triangles are, which are stations, which is right next to Mount McKinley, with all these deep events going underneath. So it's a very complex, complicated area that has just been fascinating to study. And lastly, we produce tsunami inundation maps through modeling for the Alaska coastal communities. And so that's what I'll talk about for the rest of my time. So we go back to the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964. It had a lot of deformation, about 256,000 square kilometers with a 4 to 5 minute rupture duration that moved the seafloor and the ground from up to towards 20 meters. And that is what pushes water to create tsunamis. For example here, I place the seismic source rupture for the Sumatra event. And this one, if you see the outline of the 64, this is like twice as long as that, but it didn't have as big a magnitude. So that means that the motions on it were smaller, but it had a larger surface area for driving the waves. So you get this quite large variation in the kinds of these great earthquakes you see. And the bottom line is the devil's in the details. So our involvement in tsunamis has been part of the NOAA's National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, as well as what we call the Alaska Tsunami Center and Observatory based out of UAF. Both of these came from strong support and funding from Senator Stevens. And Stevens was quite a proponent for NTHMP, and also this other activity, which was called TWEAK, and that came through funding through the, comes now as a line item through the Alaska Weather Service, part of NOAA. So the university, as Earthquake Information Center with other institutes, and heavily involving the Alaska Regional Supercomputer Center. And of course, we need many other partners. And so state and federal agencies such as the ADGGS, the State Geological Survey, the Office of Emergency Management, as well as the NOAA functions of West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center, Weather Service, their research arms such as the group in Seattle called PMEL, and critically, the National Geophysical Data Center, which helps us to put together the bathymetry and the topography we need to do the modeling of tsunamis. I just had a PhD student finished, and she had, this is one of the slides, and I wanted to show it because it's quite interesting. Why do we study tsunamis? Although earthquakes cannot be predicted, distant tsunamis can be forecasted using deep ocean bottom pressure sensors, pressure recorders. These are the so-called dart buoys. These are very interesting, and scientifically they're great, and for distant events they're fantastic, but as I said at the beginning, our hazard is local, and these will be useless for us. I heard Paul Whitmore on the radio driving over here this morning. He's the head of the Tsunami Warning Center, saying that they were really doing quite a job by using these dart buoys to help them to gauge their predictions of how big the wave was going to be in Shemya, for example. I think it was like 5 feet. Well, by the time that wave got there, and by the time the wave was recorded, it would have completely wiped out any of our communities had it been the local source that we expect. So what's more important for us is the public education and putting up signage and evacuation maps and routes and getting this kind of information out to our communities and working with our partners. The other reason to study tsunami waves is that they're easy to visualize, and that's kind of a fun thing. This is kind of a joke slide because this isn't really what it looks like. As you saw from Japan, it was just this strong surge, and the waves just went 6 miles inland without breaking waves, just surging forward like a river. Just amazing. And what was interesting about this picture is, I think this is the Golden Gate Bridge, and CNN showed a reporter sitting at the edge of the water with the Golden Gate Bridge in the background waiting for the tsunami to arrive. I mean, this was stupidity. Another reason is because the math is relatively easy, but as I said, the devil's in the details because it gets much more complicated. Many unknowns remain on the source, because typically a source, what happens is as the plates collide, they deform. When the earthquake occurs, it moves. That's a simplistic view. In particular, with the 64, everything is green here. Was uplift. Everything that's gray was subsidence. And that's how the ocean floor moved to create the wave. But in fact, it was more complicated than that, in that we had most of the release up here and then another large area of release down near Kodiak. And the effects of that are quite interesting. First of all, quickly, this just is a graphic that shows how these tsunamis get made. Whoop. This will show it even better. As the plates collide, it deforms. When the strain energy exceeds friction, it moves.
Senator Whitmer has a question, Doctor.
Yes, yeah, before we go too much further, is there any tie-in at all between earthquakes tsunamis and rogue waves, for instance?
Not really. I mean, they can be complicated or cooperative, I should say. A rogue wave just happens to be a wave that has an occurrence of several waves that constructively interfere, and all of a sudden it gets very big. Doesn't have to necessarily have a tsunami or an earthquake associated with it, but it could. Yeah. But those are a very strange phenomenon because you can have these waves out there, and all of a sudden they just all meet at the same time. They all just add together, and it's just huge.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Very good question. So let's see what I wanted to say on this is that if you look at this, this is like a long linear thing, and when it pops free and it goes to the surface again, you see that there's two lines of waves that move out in opposite directions, and they're very long and linear. That's a directivity effect, and that's what happens with big tsunamis, is that they're directed in certain directions. So the Japan one heads straight toward North America, California and those areas. Doesn't come to Alaska. Alaska seems to be positioned in such a way that these big waves from Chile, Japan, Cascadia, don't end up here. And that's why our problem is the local problem. And we have plenty of earthquakes for those. This is just showing how when this subsidence and uplift occurs, water is an incompressible fluid. So it moves up with the ocean bottom. And this happens to be a model of what happened in Sumatra. And so there's areas where the water goes up first, there's area where the water goes down first. And so when they propagate, that drawdown propagates to the east, the high wave propagates to the west. And so that's why we're heading towards Sri Lanka here with a wave that just immediately will flood. And in this deeper ocean, it goes faster, so it hits Sri Lanka first. But over in Thailand, the first wave that gets there is the drawdown. And we all know the famous story of the British girl who was on vacation who said, "Oh, I learned about this in geography class. This means a tsunami's coming." And hundreds of people were able to evacuate because of that. That's the piece of education and outreach that we should get to every community that we have. So our mapping process is to come up with many of these tsunami scenarios that can be realistic for all of our communities. Go and get the best bathymetry we can, because the bathymetry is everything in modeling these. If you don't have good bathymetry, you can't predict where the waves are going.
Sorry about giving it to them.
Do the numerical modeling. Compare that against other observations for validation. And whenever you're looking at a community that's had a tsunami, you want to model that particular tsunami as well, just to see if you're doing a good job. And we always do that. We create our inundation maps. We write a report. That report goes to the State Geological Survey. It gets peer-reviewed and then published as a professional report. In fact, we have here two copies of the report for Seward that I'll leave with you.
Okay.
And we're now putting these results onto Google Earth layers. We have them on GIS layers, but also now using Google Earth, it's more accessible to more people. So this gets the word out much better. This is a sort of a word slide that says the same thing as the last one, but I wanted to emphasize the community-based approach. I mean, we have to go to the community at the beginning, while we're doing the process at the end, because they have information that we could use. We give them information, so it's a form of education and outreach, and I think it helps in their preparedness and their mitigation in the long term. So at the end, when they get these map layers, their emergency officials, fire chiefs, city planners, engineers have a basis for developing their hazard and evacuation maps. Results, okay, this is really the devil in the details. This is the most recent source study for the 1964 earthquake. And again, we said that there was a high area to the north and a high amplitude area to the south. Those are represented by red. If we look at what happened in Kodiak by modeling with that source, you get this large wave that's heading there, and this is directly coming from that piece that was now near Kodiak. As it goes toward Kodiak, it all of a sudden turns south and heads straight into the island. And that's due to the bathymetry and the channels and the ridges that help guide these waves. That's why it's so important to have the good bathymetry. Once it gets to Kodiak, then we add a few more details to the modeling effort, and we're able to then model what happens when the water hits the shores and actually comes and overtops. This happens to be the Kodiak Naval Station that was there at the time. This allows us to then put lines on the map where the inundation happened for a particular scenario. You can then do another scenario. You put a second line. You can do as many as you can that are realistic, and that allows you to then go into this inundation map you have. Lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about the landslides from tsunamis, or tsunamis from landslides, sorry. In this case, and this is a cartoon here, this isn't real, of course, but you have this viscous material that's fully saturated, earthquake occurs, it slides down, and what it does is it draws the water down with it. And this case, if you don't get those long linear directed waves, but you get more circular patterns like a rock in a pond. This is the kind of thing that happened numerous places in 1964. I mean, the potential is very high here because we have lots of fjords that are deep and have steep walls. In this trench area, we have mountain building with lots of erosion, so lots of sediments that continue to pour into these fjords. They are then triggered by earthquakes, but not only by earthquakes. For example, this in Seward and Valdez, the earthquake triggered these huge tsunamis in 64. But in 1994 in Skagway, we had a tsunami wave that was not associated with an earthquake at all, but rather it was extremely low tide. The pore pressures in the materials just caused it to expand and fail. Those are very, very difficult because we have no way of warning for it, alarming for it. So we had several places of local waves in 64. Valdez in particular had a 52-meter high run-up or flooding from the tsunami. That tsunami was not caused by the ground motion that I've been talking about, but solely from the landslide associated with the bay outside of Valdez. Seward, on the other hand, had a 12.5-meter tsunami that was followed 30 minutes later by the tsunami generated by the seafloor displacement. So they got hit twice. I'm just about finished. This was Seward showing before the tsunami. Just after, this is a second picture that shows that all the dock structure has disappeared. The red line shows the extent of the flooding. They didn't rebuild in the area where the docks disappeared, but they did rebuild over in the tsunami zone in a different place. So that was a good thing to get away from where they were, because that's that material that's going to continually slide away. However, they put an RV park there. That was not very smart. So in the summer, if this happens, there could be 200 RVs there that become floating debris. The way we find these things out is the geologic setting here in the Seward area is shown by having very detailed bathymetry again. And you can see it's this blocky area that failed in the 64 event. And what we found, though, by looking at the entire bay is that there were 10 different areas. And this shows the computer modeling of the viscous flow. And then on the other side are the waves generated from that. So when that earthquake occurred, all these slides took off, and the waves in the fjord just started rattling all over the place. And here it is more close up. Three of them in particular had the biggest effect on Seward. From Lowell Point, 4th of July Creek, and the one right next to Seward. We show this. I'll just do this quickly. This shows just the effects of the three slides at downtown Seward, where the green arrow is. The very first slide, which is the one just off the shore, is the red line here. It shows the drawdown first, and that's exactly what happened. But then the slide from 4th of July Creek came in a little later with a much higher and positive motion. amplified then by the low point. And so it's the constructive interference of those waves that gave the biggest wave in Seward. Likewise, Fourth of July Creek has the first downdraw from the local one. Then across the bay comes the higher ones. The outputs of these show on the one side color-coordinated depths of flow of the water. For one scenario, a different scenario here, we show the drag force. And what that is the red shows the current flow that's going in through the wave breaks here in the harbor. So there's going to be very high currents from these tsunamis just pushing those boats all over the place. Summary is that we have robust computational mapping capabilities. We're working with the best high-resolution data we can. The landslide tsunami hazard's very high, and starting with Seward, we've been tackling that. And community input is extremely valuable. Which brings me back to the take-home points. I don't think I'll go through these again. I think you got them the first time, but we have big earthquakes. It's near-field earthquake and tsunami effects. People need to know what to do to save their lives. And we need partnerships. And I'll work, my task is to work on the modernization of the Alaska network. And hopefully this earthquake opportunity will go forward and we all can work on the reauthorization of the tsunami law. Thank you.
Dr. Hanson, thank you very much for the presentation. Any question by members of the committee? Senator Menard.
I had a question. I was wondering if there's any new techniques using robots for monitoring.
There for ocean bottom seismometers and ocean bottom instrumentation, they're using robotic devices to do that. That's happening right now. Okay. That's a good question.
Senator Ellis, any questions? Dr. Johnson, thank you very much. One of the questions I did have for you has to do with this Federal Tsunami Warning and Education Act. When was that supposed to sunset again?
It's the end of the fiscal year of 2012.
The other effect I had.
I'll talk with you more about that when you would like to.
Sure. Yeah. As I look at those maps there, and we see the earthquake-prone places throughout the state of Alaska, but it seems like the Aleutian Chain tends to go ahead and protect at least the Bering Sea area as well as the Arctic Ocean area from any kind of tsunami, any significant tsunami event. Is that true, or is that just something I'm drawing from an imagination?
The islands along the Aleutians, they seem to be a barrier. There's two effects going on. They stop some of the waves. They do curl around those islands and will hit places like Dutch Harbor. But as they propagate up the Bering Sea, it becomes very shallow. Mm-hmm. When it gets shallow like that, it dissipates the energy very quickly. Okay. So, for example, Nome and some of the areas and communities up in that region, we've done some preliminary look to see if there is a hazard there, and there really isn't.
Okay. As you look at the other question I had, as you look at some of these temporary sites throughout the state of Alaska that the federal government is going to be putting in place for 2 years, if the state was to take it over, what kind of financial obligation would we be under for that?
We would have to pay for the equipment at a reduced cost.
Okay. Do you have any idea what those numbers are so we can start thinking about it?
I think per site it's on the order of $35,000, and that's a good price because that's quite reduced. But then we don't have to pay for the cost of installing, mm-hmm. and it saves them the cost of having to pull it back out.
So you're talking about for all the numbers of sites that are out there, less than $1 million for the total cost?
Probably more like $5 million.
$5 million? Okay. And what words of warning can you give us as we look at some of the issues related to natural gas pipelines, since you've already had experience with the Trans-Alaska pipeline? What kind of warning can you give us for that? Obviously, we're under a much higher pressure situation, mm-hmm. and a thicker walled pipeline.
People are out surveying very hard right now to understand the earthquake potential. I think there are some areas in the Tintina Fault north of Denali that were thought inactive during the days of the oil pipeline that they're looking at more critically now for the gas pipeline. And I think that's good.
Okay.
We don't know. We don't have a crystal ball,
sure.
but those kinds of things are happening right now.
As we look at things
more like... More monitoring would be very good, because we can use the smaller earthquakes that we see with a denser network to understand more about the state of stress in the crust.
As we look at some of the issues related to global warming, et cetera, we're looking at deep water ports, the idea of rogue waves, the ideas of tsunamis. Where do you have any suggestions on where we should build a deep water port? And if you don't have any suggestions, do you have a suggestion where we should not build a deep water port in order to go ahead and make sure that it'll stay functional, especially if we have a disaster? We still have the Coast Guard out there to go ahead and help the civilian population.
Is Anchorage deep water, or is that considered? No.
She said Wasilla.
Wasilla. Because, as like I said about the Bering Sea,
sure.
If you come up the Cook Inlet, it's shallow.
Yep.
And so tsunami waves don't come all the way to Anchorage. So, but Anchorage is where you can have a great big earthquake. So,
right.
You might not get the big tsunami, but you'll get the
ground shaking. One last question has to do with, as you looked at some of the plate tectonics theory that have been going on, and you've obviously presented with your models there in your slides, are there celestial events that affect the Earth's mantle movement?
Mantle movement?
Yes.
They affect the shape of the Earth. I mean,
sure.
Other bodies and so forth. In the actual movement of the mantle, I would think not.
Okay. Okay. Any further questions, Dr. Senator Menard?
Yes, and I can appreciate you have a deep passion for what you're doing, and I thank you for all your hard work, and I know you're probably one in 10 million that like a job like this and can understand it well, so we're privileged to have you here at the table with us. But when you listed the top 10 earthquakes, you had Chile, and then you had Alaska 9.2, and I looked at it real quick. Did not Russia have a pretty heavy magnitude of an earthquake?
Well, the Kuril Islands was in there.
And it was, okay.
Yes.
I missed that.
Yeah.
So what was it, under 7 or 8? Or?
Oh, he was close to a 9 as well. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
When you said that the Japanese earthquake was registered within a few minutes of being a 9.1, was the Earth even done shaking then?
No. It's still shaking.
Okay.
Earthquakes that big cause the Earth to ring like a bell.
Sure.
And they'll ring for weeks.
Okay.
And that's when we get the final magnitude. So those waves tell us the final magnitude.
I see.
So it takes a long time.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, Dr. Hansen, thank you very much for presenting this afternoon. It's very informative and very interesting.
Thank you for our packet as well.
Yes.
Well, that came from him. Oh. But he stole some of my stuff.
He stole some of mine.
Okay, thank you. How close do you come to Seward?
Who's next?
How close do you come to Seward?
Not very close. Anchorage is very close.
Just a personal event. One of my heroes has to be a pilot that flew around Anchorage area back in the 30s. There's a lake named after him. In fact, he flew an airplane called the Stinson Jr. And that's one of the reasons I like my boy's name Jr. Because I've flown that. And with that, we have I can't remember what Dad's name was, but I remember his name was Aho. Toivo Aho's son, Dr. John Aho here, who's the chair of the Alaska Seismic Hazardous Safety Commission, to go and give us a presentation.
He's finished.
Well, yes.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for those kind words.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to skip through quite a few of my first slides because they were sort of general earthquake type stuff that Roger pretty well, I mean, did his normal good job of explaining. And my slides are, I don't have graduate students to prepare them for me, so they're not quite as nice as his. But, you know, they explain a point. And let me just get through about the first 10. I'm not even going to talk about it. I'm just going to skip through and get to a certain slide where I want to start. If I can figure out how to move this. Oh, there we go. Oh, back...
I was going to talk about terms and facts, but Roger really covered that. I'm going to talk, what can we do about tsunamis? We've learned a lot about what causes tsunamis, how we can register when a tsunami occurs, what to do after tsunami, but what can we do to prevent the damage that we're seeing, and what is being done at this particular point in Alaska? And the answer, unfortunately, is not much. From a design standpoint, the codes address ground shaking, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. They don't address ground rupture, ground failure, or tsunami. And so those things are really neglected in our designs to date. And so communities that are along the seacoast that have the potential for experiencing a very large tsunami are going to be damaged substantially. We don't design structures to prevent tsunami damage. And that's we probably don't do it because it's pretty difficult to do. And what can be done is, in the future, we don't build in those areas anymore. There's nothing that we can be done that can be done in the areas that have been built. And so we just have to think about how we build in the future, where we build in the future, and then always address the ground shaking aspect of earthquakes, because we can design to resist that. Okay, I'm going to go through a lot of this stuff.
Senator Menard, do you have a question?
I
wanted to talk.
Dr. Aho, Senator Menard has a comment or a question.
No, I was just saying, I was just flipping back in my mind about, you know, how people just love to live on water, no matter if they know there's a fault there, or they still want that water property. And that's an awful, hard, difficult argument for you to make, you know, that we just have to stop building in these areas, because, you know, typically that's like a lifelong dream to look at that water or be near where there's a fault or...
Yes. Yeah. Senator Menard, I think that's true. And I think when it comes to single-family residences and things of that nature in Alaska, you're not going to prevent people from doing that. And, you know, I mean, I would love to live by the ocean also. I think it's... I'm speaking more to multi-family, large buildings... built in those areas. We should build those away from landslide areas and away from tsunami inundation areas. As far as tsunami in Alaska is concerned, when there's a tsunami in Japan, we have minutes or hours before where we can get a warning and we can get away from the area. If it's a near source earthquake that generates the tsunami, then the warning is the earthquake itself. When you feel it, you run if you're in one of those areas. And we had a particular case in Anchorage. I had a call from a person in Anchorage that was watching television when the Japanese earthquake occurred. A tsunami warning came on the television. It was garbled. He got his parents up. They got dressed. And they sat in the front of the television waiting for the next message, and they got nothing. And so what happens in when we do the tsunami drills, we have the agencies and all of the government-type individuals get together, and they run these drills and maybe other businesses, and then they talk about it, but the general public itself isn't really addressed. And this was this is an instance where people didn't know what to do, and there was no follow-up information to tell them what to do. So they sat there, you know, in their clothes waiting for something. Anyway, just a side story. Okay, real quickly, from a ground shaking standpoint, when we design, I've shown the cartoon here, a graph here, where we show a curve that's labeled design, and then I show the curve that's the actual capacity of the structure, which is slightly higher than the design because of overstrength of materials and safety factors and other things that we do. But the actual force that needs to be resisted from an earthquake is substantially higher than that. And the only reason that can be resisted by well-designed structures is through what's called ductility and redundancy. Redundancy means that if one member fails, there's alternate load paths for the loads to go without total failure of the structure. And ductility is the ability to withstand inelastic strain without fracture, the ability to bend without breaking. And if you don't have those two items working, then it's almost impossible to to resist the actual demand from an earthquake. We can't afford to demand to design structures to that higher earthquake level. It would just be too expensive, so we have to depend on detailing to ensure that we get proper reaction from the structures. Okay, causes of damage, tsunami, ground failure, ground rupture, ground shaking. Tsunami, ground rupture, and ground failure, I mentioned that the codes don't address that. And what we have to recognize is earthquake design through the Uniform Building Codes or the International Building Codes is a very complicated situation. It's not something that you take a person fresh out of school who could design a column or a beam and say, okay, do the seismic analysis on this particular building. It's something, in my opinion, that it should almost be like a residency for engineers, like doctors have residencies, to really get involved in seismic engineering. And I'll speak to that a little more when I talk about the seismic commission, because there's some things we'd like to do in relation to that. Okay, so... And I've just shown some pictures of tsunami. This is the Japan, and probably some of that is ground shaking damage. And here we have, of course, Seward, various pictures from the Seward tsunami. Again, we really don't do anything in our current design techniques to prevent failures of structures in a tsunami area. One of the things that's done after every major earthquake is we go into areas where the earthquake occurred and we look at buildings and structures that were damaged in that particular area. We try to determine why the damage occurred, what mistakes in design and construction materials and construction itself led to that particular failure, and then we try to modify codes and design techniques to prevent things like that from happening for that particular structure type in the future. And another thing we do is we look at buildings that have actually survived, because we want to know why buildings survived and why they did better than other buildings. And when you're doing a structural design, we have to worry not only about the structural natural frequency, but we have to worry about the ground natural frequency. We have to make sure that the ground natural frequency is not in resonance with the structure frequency, because we can get major deflection failures because of that, if that happens. Okay, this is not ground failure, unfortunately. We've forgotten about New Zealand, of course. New Zealand, Christchurch has been substantially damaged, and it will take a long time to recover. And, you know, Japan is taking a lot of our attention right now, but we shouldn't forget that New Zealand has had substantial damage also. And this is, Roger showed a couple of these slides, but this is just examples of ground failure. Ground failure is a slope failure at the Government Hill High School and the failure at the Turnagain Heights. And then we have ground rupture at the Denali Fault in the lower right-hand corner. And then we have a ground failure, lateral spreading of Northway Airport and so on. Now, how can we design against that? We can't. We don't want to design near areas of known faults. We don't want to site major structures in areas of known faults. We don't want to site structures in areas where there could be massive ground failure. And unfortunately, we've done that. Some people have done that. And then liquefaction. Liquefaction is another thing. As a structural engineer, I have to make one basic assumption, and that's the foundation material will remain under the structure after the earthquake. If I can't make that logical assumption, I shouldn't be designing. The left-hand side picture is Kobe, Japan, and I consider that person on the third floor there as one of the world's foremost optimists. Or he's never heard of the concept of aftershocks. Okay, going back to tsunamis for a minute, I was on a review team for this Guidelines for Design of Structures for Vertical Evacuation from Tsunamis, and this shows you some pictures on the right-hand side of particular evacuation structures that you could sit at the RV park in Seward. You could put one of these structures that would handle the lower right hand would handle you know, 50 people. So there's an immediate method of getting above the potential tsunami wave height, and you could place these in areas where, you know, older people or visitors or whatever would need to get high and out of the way very quickly. Mm-hmm. And Cannon Beach, California, Oregon, is one of the places now is considering putting these in. These structures up in the upper right-hand corner are structures from Japan. Unfortunately, there were none of those in the area where the tsunami, current tsunami, occurred. And there were older people that weren't able to run fast enough and that died in that particular tsunami because there was nothing like this for them to get up into. And then in the lower right-hand, lower left-hand corner, this is probably for a novice, and I consider architects from an earthquake engineering standpoint novices. It's a really good book. It's free from FEMA. If you have any interest in earthquakes and buildings and things like that, this is it's really a non-real technical person would really enjoy that book, and it's free.
Senator Menard.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question right away. I have to get this answered. Oh. Yes. Tell me the percentage of times, as far back as you can go, that an earthquake has returned to the exact same place, say like Seward, that earthquake hack. And then, I mean, in my history, I can't remember where there's been a major tsunami in that exact same place. Once they've gone through it, then it's kind of like...
Yeah,
I
don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, we've had strong ground shaking in Anchorage, for example, over many different decades.
And
what happens is, you know, we have the concept of seismic risk and seismic hazard. Seismic hazard is the potential occurrence. Seismic risk is the consequence of that occurrence, and sometimes people mix those terms together. You take Anchorage, for example. In 1915, they had very few buildings, wood structures, low rise, some big earthquakes, but the risk was very low. The hazard was there, and you go 100 years or later, the hazard's still there, but the risk is much higher. And so I think we've had earthquakes in these cities all over Alaska, but you know the risk becomes greater and greater because of more population and more infrastructure. Because so, my dad, my uncle talked about earthquakes in the 30s and earlier that shook Anchorage very hard, but we didn't have very big buildings back then.
Senator Menard, please.
I know we're running out of time. I was relating that because, you know, of course, where the Anchorage earthquake occurred, they're building it up again, and there's homes again, and they're thinking in their head, well, what are the chances that that's going to happen in that exact place again? And so it's
My answer is it will happen again.
In our lifetime.
It may not be that particular fault, the same fault system.
In our lifetime.
I can't be that exact, okay. But we have 25,000 earthquakes a year in Alaska, and you know sooner or later there's going to be another big one. We've had magnitude 8 earthquakes along the Aleutian Chain every 10 years or so, and so you know I think it's going to happen. I can't predict them.
Okay, sure.
Okay, I'm going to move very quickly now. I can see people. I want to get through some of this stuff. This is just damage that we can, as structural designers, I can design for any known shaking from earthquakes. Where I have a problem is if I can't assume that the ground's going to stay under the building. Okay, current research, we're all familiar with the ground failure map that was produced in Anchorage many years ago. That's been updated. There's other things happening because of that map. But we also have, there's 32 channels of 32 instruments throughout Anchorage to give us an idea of how the acceleration varies as we move across the city. And that's one of the types of instruments that's in each of those locations. And that's a very densely instrumented area for a city. We also have 6 instruments down to 200 feet in that fenced area there, and 32 channels of instrumentation in the Atwood building, and this just shows the downhole instrumentation, and it shows you the where the instruments are in the six holes. We can look at the incoming seismic wave from that. We have instrumentation in the Atwood building that looks like this, accelerometers in the direction you see there. So we can look at building translatory motion. We can look at torsion of the building. We can look at interstory drift. We can look at foundation rocking. And then looking at the Denali or the Delaney Park downhole instrumentation and the building response, we can look at what's called site structure interaction. So there's some really interesting stuff coming out of there. There's been about 32 peer-reviewed papers from that particular instrumentation and quite a few presentations throughout the country. It's one of the most instrumented buildings in the country. And this just shows the accelerometers that are in the Atwood building. And the three instruments off to the right there are the data recorders. And we also have instrumentation in the Frontier building. Okay, Seismic Safety Commission. Sorry I have to talk so fast, but.
Yeah, just a quarter to our General Cactus has an engagement to go ahead and meet, so a quarter to, I promise.
Oh, okay. I'm going to. Membership, Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, there's our members, 11 members, many very well-known people with extremely incredible credentials, in my opinion. It's an honor to lead it. These are our powers and duties, and I'm not going to read all of them, but you see, we have a lot to do. Sometimes very little time to do it. To respond to those particular powers and duties, we have formed standing committees in schools, earthquake scenario, education outreach, etc. And each of those have a committee chairman. Each of these are very active. The 2014 conference planning is there'll be earthquake engineers from all over the world coming to Anchorage in 2014 for a major U.S. Earthquake Engineering Conference, so that'll be a pretty big deal. This is a map that's been produced by our schools committee that identifies school. You can't read it, unfortunately, but if you look in your report, you'll see that map in the annual report. It identifies schools in seismically vulnerable areas, and we're looking at that right now. These are our accomplishments. I won't read all those because I've given you the slides, but we've done a lot in the last year. And one important thing that we've done is we provided post-disaster structure safety assessment training to 45 people. We had a sign-up list went out, and a week later we had full classes. We have enough for three more classes now on the waiting list, so it's very popular. And we're also working with seismic commissions around the country in developing some interaction that we can do. And then just more accomplishments that you can read about in the paper. We have two policy recommendations in our current annual report. Number one is to identify at-risk school facilities. Number two is for all future design, construction, and major renovations, design proficiency that the person must have design proficiency in earthquake engineering. There should be an independent peer review of seismic designs and on-site observation during construction of earthquake-related items. And things like this, if it's done properly for new construction and major renovations, I think will lead to a substantial safer school for Alaska. And that's my dad in his teens with his first airplane.
Good.
Okay.
Dr. Ahill, thank you very much for your presentation. Very enlightening.
Any questions?
Any questions, Senator Bernard?
I asked them all during the
okay.
Did I talk too fast?
No, I don't think so.
Perfect. Okay. Absolutely perfect.
Thanks.
With that, General Cactus, I'd like you to come on up here and as a representative from the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. Identify yourself for the record, please, and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Thomas Katkus. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and also the Adjutant General for the State of Alaska. Thank you very much for having us today. I'm going to be very abbreviated since those were great presentations and really stole most of our thunder. So what I'd like to do is just basically stress the fact that in our current situation, we are really going to be looking at the individual preparedness, as was hit on already, the short time frame that you have to react to some of these tsunamis and or earthquakes. Those are the real hazards and threats that our local citizenry should be very much aware of. And I think with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, the section, our Homeland Security Emergency Management, I think it's really important that we get across our efforts to bring synergy to first responders' efforts. The fact that we are not first responders, we really make sure everybody's on the same sheet of music, the same message is out, the public feels assured that we are quickly and efficiently and effectively bringing to bear all of our resources we have as a state on a problem, and have the confidence that we have reach back and the ability to bring even additional more resources in. So what I'd like to do is introduce Mr. Michael Hare and cover, just on tsunami alone, our response and our public education and our process for addressing that particular hazard, realizing we are an all-hazards response element to the state of Alaska. Mr. Hare.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management for the State of Alaska, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And I will give you the 50-cent tour on how the State of Alaska prepares and responds to a tsunami and how we outreach and prepare Alaskans for an earthquake event. How we operate is all about partnerships. We cannot operate in a all-hazards disaster environment without our partners. And as you can see, these wonderful gentlemen behind me, we know each other, we work with our staffs, we prepare, plan, make maps, and help communities get communities vital information so that they can better prepare those communities for earthquake preparedness or tsunami evacuation plans and procedures. Quick map, you've seen some great maps today, and this kind of is a low-rent map, but it shows distant threat communities, tsunami vulnerable communities for distant threats. You see the color codes is high down to the none or negligible of the interior, but I want to echo what my colleague said prior. Local tsunamis are the nightmare of the state of Alaska for preparing and planning and alerting local citizens to get to high ground and be prepared and save their lives. So I agree wholeheartedly with them. Quick map just to identify the tsunami warning sirens located in around the state of Alaska and also the tsunami ready communities. Those, sorry for the blur, but the yellow triangles are the tsunami ready communities. There's seven of them: Seward, Homer, Kodiak, Sitka, Valdez, Yakutat, and Sandpoint. We're developing several more on Alaska, Cordova, Whittier. Whittier are completing their requirements for the summer. It is totally voluntary mission. There's no requirement for them to do so. It is in their own accord and volition to better prepare their communities for tsunami. Other interested communities are Cold Bay and King Cove and St. Paul. To be a tsunami-ready community, you have to establish a 24-hour warning system and have an emergency operations center on scene. You have to have multiple ways to communicate and relay these alerts and warnings out to your community, and if it's a hub community, to your satellite communities that are involved. And that could be marine band radio, satellite phone, could be VSAT communications, whatever that may be, and is appropriate for the communities. The community notification map, how that works is as we, from the Tsunami Warning Center and the modeling that goes on from a lot of the scientists involved in the process, the state of Alaska gets alerts and warnings on earthquakes and possible tsunamis, advisories and alerts and warnings, and we activate the SECC accordingly. Primarily what we do is we get a quick understanding of where the immediate affected zones may be, state being broken out, the coastal communities broken out in zones, and via the modeling we can see which zones would be impacted first and identify those as a priority for the call down list and work our way out from the priorities to the less affected modeled communities, but we call them all and let them know. So what my staff does is we occupy the State Emergency Coordination Center. We have call out lists. As you can see, for example, Zone B has those appropriate communities there with several appropriate numbers. We know the individuals in those communities. They know my staff. We've got great relationships with them. We've got multiple phone and contact numbers. We don't stop dialing until we get a warm body. So that's the sort of fail-safe manual relay that always typically seems to work. And then from there, once we get a hold of those communities, we advise them to take their local action to warn their communities. And if it's a tsunami warning that could affect their community, to work out their evacuation plans to higher ground or shelter in place. So just to give you an idea how we operate, and that's exactly what we did that Thursday night when we got the alert from Japan. We've seen a whole bunch of inundation maps. This is Seward. It doesn't do it justice. Dr. Hansen develops these maps for my staff, for my hazard mitigation staff. He works hand-in-hand with those folks, and we develop some great maps. These allow the local communities. I'll show you another one. Homer, for instance, stay out of the white zone. I guess it's a pretty easy shot. It allows those communities to understand where that inundation is going to be, make their identify their plans accordingly, work their evacuation routes from there, and be better prepared. The warning sirens. You've seen some of these warning sirens in the communities. They range from more advanced warning sirens that have the old World War II air raid kind of siren sound to the more advanced, which actually include the big voice. You can program a big voice, which you can actually accommodate any event and alert the local communities. Same thing, a couple here, Chicken Bay, Perryville.
Senator Menard.
What is the cost of one of those warning?
Yes, ma'am. They vary. The more advanced sirens would cost about $300,000. The less expensive ones, of course, would be less, about $100,000. And they get better and cheaper and faster as technology improves. And what we try and do is to identify the best type of technology for the community that the money can buy, because we try and spread it out as much as possible.
And where are they manufactured? Do you know that?
All over the country, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Some more simplified warning signs, Atkin-Nikolsky, and they're located in important places, EOCs, fire departments, the town halls, evacuation shelters, preferably high ground areas, but the community makes a determination where the best place would be. And with our partners, we help advise them as to the best place. And here's just a little innovation here. Key and I upgraded one of their sirens and took one of their old sirens and put it on a truck for a mobile device, so that you can actually, if you're on dip net season or something, you can run down to the beach and set the alarms off or augment one that may not have worked or non-functioned. So jumping through some tsunami signs you've seen before, hazard zones, evacuation areas, evacuation shelters, and the routes, of course. And here's examples in Homer on routes, and that they are a tsunami-ready community, which is great.
I've never seen those signs before.
Hopefully now you'll recognize them. And typically you don't until you see them, and you'll see them, ma'am, I promise.
Must be in Wasilla.
Also on outreach and education, our quake cabin is a great tool that we use in local communities. We use it in schools and businesses, state fairs, and safety events. It's an earthquake simulator. It's a cabin where you sit down three individuals, strap them in harnesses and flight harnesses, and you dial up to a 5.0 magnitude earthquake, and it simulates being in the house with furniture in the house that's actually seismically safe, strapped in, bracketed in, but it still moves, and it allows individuals to see, wow, at 5.0, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it can do. And then we, of course, educate that it was 9.2 that really affected, that was a big effect on the state of Alaska. So, and really allow us to provide great outreach and understanding. Kids love it in school because you get them notified. They're our best resources to alert the parents, get the kids involved in it, and it's terrific.
Senator Menard.
So accordingly, do you ramp it up then to 9.2?
No, ma'am. No. It maxes out at 5. If it went to 9.2, it'd fall apart.
No.
Yep. Some of the outreach products, you've got your blue bags, our gift to you. And I didn't mean to steal your thunder and your earthquake books, but some great information on earthquake and tsunami preparedness, as well as volcano preparedness. great kids' books, Center for the Kids, coloring books, and but with a real good message to it. And I also want to draw your attention to Ocean's Fury, is the some great footage of that, of the very big tsunamis here in Alaska, and it really gives you an understanding of the impact. An educated and aware public with a plan of action will have the ability to adapt to any situation and respond accordingly. That's the mantra. Prepare themselves for the devastation and destruction that happened in Japan, that happened to us in 64 and other events throughout our history. But if we inform the public better and have them better prepared, we will save lives. We will save more lives. So I'll close by just saying, as individuals, as family members, as community members, as community leaders, as state leaders, please address your constituents. If you have a plan, make a kit, be informed, and I'll segue off to Valdez here. Go to www.ready.alaska.gov. You will find all of the tools necessary to build your 7-day survival kits, how to put one together over a period of time so it's not such a big inundation to you. Also have some tips on a lot of household products that you have at home or household ideas that will help you put your kit together. And that, ma'am, concludes, and sir, Mr. Chairman, concludes my presentation. I hope I didn't take too much time.
Senator Menard.
I didn't ask, but I can make something up. On the kits, okay, I'll ask about the kits. Have you explored having, like, say, Home Depot or Lowe's put the kit together and for people, and then they can go to one-stop headquarters and pick that kit up all completely?
Yes, ma'am. Actually, Costco started that whole program of having a 3-day family food kit in a bucket.
Okay.
Which was one of the first parts. So, what you'll understand if you go to the website and see what your plan process of getting prepared looks like, you've got all the stuff at home. You've got a lot of the stuff at home. It just needs to be put into one spot, and you need to know where it is, and you need to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Great idea, and it's already been starting. I think it's going to continue on, but. Understand that a lot of these items that you have at home,
okay,
it'll be helpful at home. Just you have to put them in together.
Okay.
As you look at some of the escape routes, and then you have these quake cabins, for more for an earthquake, but you have a tsunami shelter. How high do you recommend? What's the minimum amount of elevation amongst the mean sea level that you say that you should go to?
Sir, I'll leave it to the scientists to answer that one. The local inundation maps, which help identify the best escape routes to get to the appropriate high ground. I'm not sure what the maximum threshold by which it was identified to get to that point, but if it's identified as a high ground safety area, mm-hmm, you're safe there.
About 50 feet?
It depends on the location.
Okay.
50 feet would probably be good in most cases. But
okay.
But
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, they talked about a 52 meter wave swell that went out of Valdez. I mean, that's 160 feet high. And so, you know, you want to be prepared for that if it's coming at you.
You get as high as you can get, sir.
Sure. The other question I had is, as you get the time between when the wave withdrawal happens and the water goes out until the wave surge comes,
yes, sir,
what's that time frame?
Well, it's actually, as far as the methodology to understand, to be prepared, you don't. As soon as the earthquake is over,
mm-hmm,
get to high ground. Don't wait for the sirens. Know that you're in a coastal community and it could be affected. You get to high ground immediately. You grab your family. Don't worry about grabbing your stuff. You get to high ground. There was an instance in the Japanese earthquake. I saw a presentation a couple of days ago, and I don't mean to go on, but it's pretty pertinent. An elderly husband and wife were running from that tsunami that we saw on TV. Up to high ground, and they just grabbed what they could in each other and started running up. The husband stopped to put his shoes on, said, "You go." He didn't make it. She made it.
Yeah.
You got to just keep going. So The rule of thumb is you don't wait for the alarms, you don't wait for a time period, you grab your most valuable possessions and get to high ground as quickly as possible.
But for those of us without any experience, I mean, the story anecdotally is that a person saw the wave go out,
sure,
realized that bad things were happening because of some type of elementary school education,
sure,
and then
sure
ran for high ground, and she was safe. So I'm assuming that several minutes.
Well, the Japanese event, they had some had 10 minutes, some had 15 minutes.
Okay.
Depends on the localized event and where you are in relation to that local slide or cause of that tsunami. Mm-hmm. You may have no time whatsoever, sir.
Dr. Hansen, you feel like you want to say something.
He does. He's great at this stuff.
What kind of time frame are we looking at?
Well, that 15, 20 minutes is if it's the earthquake-generated tsunami. But if you're in Seward and it's a landslide tsunami,
mm-hmm,
it's 60 to 90 seconds.
I think you want you up here next to the microphone where you can get recorded.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, you jump.
I just pull up another chair.
I was just saying that if you're in a place where it's an earthquake-generated tsunami and it's a drawdown first, like in Sumatra, it could be as great as 20 minutes before that wave comes back in. But if you're in a place like Seward, where it's a landslide-generated tsunami, it might be 60 to 90 seconds because they're a much different kind of wave generated in a different scale, so it's higher frequency. So it depends on the case. And that's why the local landslide tsunamis are so dangerous here in Alaska.
Okay. Senator Bernard?
I just thought I'd end with this. Where do you predict the next big earthquake will be?
It's going to start in southern Kodiak and go through the, follow the trench for...
Down toward Juneau?
No.
Oh, down the other way?
Yeah, going along the trench, mm-hmm, out toward Dutch Harbor.
I see.
And we don't really predict. This happens to be a source that is being considered as a scientific project for an all-hazards program, where that happens to be an area that is particularly vulnerable to sending a tsunami down to Southern California. So we're participating in a program where if we have an event like the 64 or the Sumatra, like I showed in those maps, along that area, it would be devastating to us, but it also would be about the worst case scenario for California.
Okay. The last question I had, as you looked at the map for the tsunami warning communities out there, the only one on the north side of the Aleutian Chain was St. Paul. Why was St. Paul chosen as, well, everybody else, Perryville, King Cove, Sandpoint, was all on the south side?
St. Paul is right on the shelf edge.
Oh, it is.
So if you go out to the west from St. Paul, it's much deeper ocean.
I see.
That shelf edge is going to really start to reduce the waves. So they'll see some big waves in St. Paul.
Okay. No further questions, no further comments. Thank you very much for your presentation this afternoon. Very informative, obviously very interesting, especially pertinent with what's going on in Japan right now.
Sure.
With that, I'd like to go ahead and announce we're going to have another meeting on Thursday, which is going to be March 24th at 3:30 p.m. here at the Belts Room. With that, this is nothing else before to come before the committee. We're adjourned.
Where are you?